Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Welcome you to the Senate Committee on Judiciary, right early on President's Day. We have a couple of different things we're going to be doing today. We have a possible introduction of committee bills. We also have work sessions and public hearings. So the chair is going to entertain a motion for the introduction of LC 250, LC 1166, LC 2609, LC 2813, and LC 3061 as committee bills.
Mr. Chair.
So moved on the five pre-mentioned bills.
Thank you. Senator Berquist moves those five LCs as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this time, we're going to go ahead and start our public hearings. We'll start with Senate Bill 313. Open the public hearing in council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 313 comes to this committee from Senator Pozanski. Creates an evidentiary privilege for parents and children that would not force either to testify against other concerning communications between parent and child.
Thank you very much. I will just give a quick background. This is something that came to my attention a couple of years ago when we introduced the bill for a particular individual. I, on my own accord this time, thought that it was needed to be reintroduced, and so I did that. And we have some numerous people here. It's the intent of the chair at this point to take testimony. There is apparently some bills that are on the House side that are dealing with possible limiting privileges. And what I've told one of the supporters of that we would look at all of these and possibly have one bill that might move forward. So at this point, the chair is going to entertain the testimony, and then we will not go into work session on this one today, and we'll see what, if anything, happens after that. Let's start off with, I got Katie Berger, Sheila Montgomery, and Gail Meyer. I'm going to have Gail come up, and then we have one other person that's signed on the proponent's perspective, and then we have one person at this time objecting. So those first three, if you all come on up. I don't know who wants to start off, you or Gail, but I'll let y'all decide, and then Sheila will be following.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. I'm Gail Meyer, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I do have here with me today Kathy Berger, who is a very experienced attorney, both in terms of defending juveniles in the context of criminal delinquency adjudications, but then also in adult court as well. And I had asked Susan Reese to also appear, and she was going to testify today instead of myself, but she came down with the flu. Susan's experience is also very well informed. Ms. Reese has been a practitioner for 30 years doing exclusively criminal defense in the context of, and also family representation as well. The dilemma and the conundrum of a parent who wants to continue to be a parent to their child when their child is in trouble is quite severe. If you look at the literature, it really tailors it down to a three-point prong analysis for the parent if they get a subpoena and they're being asked to testify against something their child told them. Do they want to go into the courtroom and lie and protect their child? The answer would be no. Do they want to refuse to honor the subpoena and be held in contempt of court? The answer would be no. Do they want to honor the subpoena, come to court, be an agent on behalf of the state to convict their child and possibly send their child to prison? That answer would also, in all most probabilities, be no. The dilemma of a parent in this instance can be quite overwhelming. I have seen it unfold in my own practice. Ms. Reese, if she were here today, wanted to relate a particular story that she had that I think highlights the need for the bill. She was representing a juvenile who was 15 years of age, got in trouble out there in the world, got involved in some drug activity and also some allegations of some burglaries. had come home and had made some statements to the mother, and then the mother was the one that had contacted Ms. Reese for the purpose of representation, and Ms. Reese's client was the child. At some point, though, Ms. Reese had to communicate to the family, "You cannot discuss this." So she had to tell the child and she had to tell the parents, "I know these are very serious charges, but you cannot discuss this with your child and you cannot counsel or advise your child with respect to the ongoing adjudication." That was difficult for the parents to accept, but they did follow that advice. But then at some point, the state served a subpoena on the mother because the mother was going to be able to report what it is her son had told her. And shortly after the subpoena was served, the child took off and absconded and is now a runaway. The parent would have wanted to testify here in person today, but she now resides down in California, and so she could not make the trip up for that purpose. She has no proof. No one would. But she does feel that the service of the subpoena upon her for the purpose of repeating in court what her son had told her definitely probably weighed into the son's decision to leave. There's so easy, it's so often with privilege analysis to just focus on how does it impact the case itself, how does it impact the adjudication, but we forget about what someone else was calling the reentry process. I mean, we want these parents to remain the support system for the child, and even as the child goes through the adjudication, if they are convicted, at some point they're going to get back out of the prison, the institution again, and they're going to come back home. And we have to think about how nurturing of an environment it is for that child to come back into the home and hopefully through reentry adjust to society and be more law-abiding if, in fact, they feel that family members have not been a safe haven for them all throughout the time. So on behalf of OCDLA and many more who could have told many other stories, we heartily support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Kathy?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. My name is Kathy Berger. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and for over 19 years now, I've specialized in representing juveniles. First, I represented only juveniles, and currently I specialize in representing juveniles on very serious charges. I always have said that representing kids on delinquency cases in juvenile court is like trying to play chess in 3D with your eyes closed. It's a lot more difficult, I think, than representing adults in criminal court, because not only do you have to pay attention to what's happening in the case, but you have to be very cognizant of what's happening in the relationships with your client, especially the relationships between your client and their family. Because studies have shown that the kids that are the most successful are the ones that have the best relationships with their parents. I mean, we see all the time on TV the anti-drug commercials where they talk to the parents about you need to talk to your children. We tell children that the parent is the one that they should go and talk to when they have problems. And so we understand in our society that parent-child relationship is a very important relationship for the development of the child until the child gets in trouble. And that's a child that actually needs their parent the most. And at that point, as an attorney, because there is no confidential communication between children and parents, I have to, as Gail mentioned earlier, warn both the parent and the child not to speak about the underlying events that have caused a delinquency petition or an indictment to be filed against the child. That means I need to tell them you can't talk about what's going on, you can't talk to them about what happened, you can't talk about it. Yet I often will have a young teenager in front of me needing to make a life-changing decision, and I have to tell them, well, you can talk to your parent about it, but you can't tell your parent what actually happened. You can't tell your parent what the cause and what was behind what actually happened, but okay, make a decision about whether you want to plead guilty to this charge or not. And that's a very difficult position to put a parent in. Can you imagine if you were a parent of a teenager who got sick and the doctor said, oh, your child's sick, but I can't really tell you anything about what's happening to your child. I think every parent on the face of the earth would raise holy hell and go take that child to another medical practitioner who would include them in their decision-making process. And it becomes almost impossible to include the parent in the decision-making process because the parent can't be told what's going on. I've seen many, many different types of parenting styles in my years of representing children, some that are extremely good and some that are so bad that I would probably risk life and limb to make sure that those children didn't have to live with that parent any longer. But the reality is that we aren't able to even start to judge or work on improving a child parent-child relationship when at the moment that there's the biggest trauma in the family's life, in all probability, we are separating that parent and the child. Most kids who get caught up in delinquency or criminal activity have to some extent separated from their parents. They're to some extent not wanting their parents to know what's going on, and if the parents are allowed to let that to continue, it causes even more problems. A kid in juvenile court, when you have a parent that can't know what's going on, it's hard for the professionals to be able to then decide if there's some help that that parent could use to improve that parent-child relationship, because the parent's acting as somebody who doesn't know what's going on because they don't know what's going on. But if we are able to allow the parent and child to have interaction about what's going on, we can then determine if that parent's willing to step up and take responsibility and help the child take responsibility, or whether this is really an absent parent who really doesn't care what's happening with their child. This bill, I think, does a lot of really good things. I have to say that in my many years of representing juveniles, I can't think of one case that I had that would have been made or broken by the state if they could not have had the parent testify against the child. The reality is often there's a lot of evidence for the state if the child has actually committed a delinquent act or a criminal act. They don't necessarily need the confession to the parent in order to prove the case. What this does, however, is it, because there's the chance that they could have to testify against their child, you need to kick the parents out of the room when you're talking to the child about what happened and what's going to happen in their future. And I think that's just the wrong message to send to the parents of Oregon.
Thank you. Ms. Montgomery.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm here today to support Senate Bill 313. My name is Sheila Montgomery, and I'm the mother of three teenage sons and a 7-year-old daughter. And as a parent, that I know that breaking the confidence of my children to potentially support their potential conviction could have a troubling impact on families and also a negative impact on the long-term public safety. Several years ago, my son got into trouble, and when my son, Zach, had just turned 15, he was going through a tough time. He had just been diagnosed bipolar, which is a challenging mental illness. He was also struggling with the death of several of our family members that had passed away. And unknown to me, Zach went off of his medication, and for a period of about a week, he had ran away and got involved with the wrong person. And the guy he was staying with wanted to rob a store, so my son went about an hour before the robbery happened and checked out the store. And then while the robbery occurred, he sat in the guy's car while it took place. Thank God no one was hurt in the incident. Zach came home shortly after the robbery took place and was arrested soon after. Though he was a few months over 15 years of age, he was automatically remanded to the adult court system since robbery is a Measure 11 charge. and makes no distinctions between adults and juveniles. Youth automatically being treated as adults is a problem in our that I hope that the legislatures will take up and deal with in a separate legislation. Thankfully, during my son's interaction with the criminal justice system, I was never put in a position to where I had information that forced me to break my son's confidence and assist in his conviction. That would have been very difficult for both of us. I can imagine that if that was the case, my son would have felt like I had violated our mutual trust, and it would have seriously jeopardized our relationship. Rather than me being able to support my son, I would have been alienated from him. Eventually, my son's story got some press coverage where he was highlighted as an example of the unjust system of automatically treating youth as adults via Measure 11, especially for first-time offenders. And because of that exposure, the DA's office changed his release, and he did not end up serving the full 90-month sentence that he was sanctioned to. I am thankful for that outcome, yet this bill makes me wonder how comfortable my son would have been coming home to a parent that would have possibly helped to convict him. And at that time where he needed my love and support, I fear that if I had to been forced to testify against him and break his confidence, perhaps he may never have wanted to come back home. Allowing parents to be parents and to keep our children's confidence can have a positive impact for Oregon. And I think that this proposed law makes it more likely that families can stay connected during troubling times. We need to think about the reentry process. If we break down the family structure and support system, what is left when the child comes home after detention? Allowing parental privilege makes it more likely families can be a strong support system to help young people succeed when they come home. Senate Bill 313 takes a long-term and holistic view toward public safety. The criminal justice system needs tools to keep youth accountable, but we also need to figure out a way to support families in the process. Promoting policies that help sustain healthy parental relationships makes it more likely we will keep young people headed in the right direction in the long run. I'm happy to say that my family is stronger, and despite the trauma that took place with this event, that Zach has had hurdles associated with having an adult felony conviction on his record, yet he is in college and he's taken one day at a time. He knows that I love him and I'm there to help him, but as a parent, helping him doesn't mean letting him escape accountability if he does something wrong, but it does mean that I will try to not break his trust. I hope you support Senate Bill 313 as a way to preserve the strength of family relationships. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Colleagues, are there any questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Just a scenario to get something in mind. Let's say that a mother witnessed her minor son murdering the mother's boyfriend, and the mother thought the boyfriend maybe needed life-ending therapy or may have even encouraged the application of such. In this case, there was no crime against the child, there was no crime against the parent, and the child certainly wasn't abused. The mother could not be compelled as the only eyewitness to testify against the son, even if she might have put the son up to it.
Chair Przomski and Senator Wissett, as I read Senate Bill 313, it's limited only to confidential communications by the child to the parent. And so what a parent sees is not privileged. So, for instance, suppose a child was accused of committing an offense and claimed an alibi. I was home at that time watching TV. My mom was in the house. The parent could be called to say, no, my son wasn't home that night. What is being protected by Senate Bill 13, if I read it correctly, is that it's simply confidential communications made by the child to the parent. So it's what the child says in confidence.
So then if the child murdered the boyfriend in the absence of the mother and then told the mother of the occurrence, it would be privileged even though she might. Okay.
Chair Przomski and Senator Wittsitt, yes, that's as I read the bill.
Yeah. Let me clarify, though. I think that there is the possibility, if the mother wanted to break the privilege, because if you look online,
oh, yes,
17 and 18, it should have that right.
Yes.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and any one of the panel members can ask this. I looked through the bill, and in the measure summary, it makes mention, and then in the text, it says that the child must declare they want it to be privileged. Is there anything in the bill that indicates that the child would be advised that that right exists, or we continue marching down the road we have now, which is many children are pressed to make statements? You following my question? I mean, what we have very simply in here is it says the child or the mother must declare that they don't want to give a statement. Now, if they're not advised they have that right, they're not going to know that right exists. Mm. And there's nothing in the bill to indicate that the mother or the parent would be advised that they have that right. Mm.
Okay, go ahead.
I'll try.
Chair Prusansky, Senator Boquist, I think I understand what you're saying.
Certainly, if I was representing a child and the parent was being subpoenaed by the state, I don't think it would be unethical for me to advise the parent that they may have a privilege and that they should seek legal advice about whether or not they wish to, what that privilege may be. I certainly, as the child's attorney, would be ethically obligated to tell the child that the child has the privilege and assert the privilege on behalf of the child. Certainly there are cases that children are not represented by attorneys when are alleged to have committed delinquent acts. Those cases are not numerous, I don't believe, when you're looking at the more severe of charges. Certainly, I would think that was probably the case. It would be more likely the case when you're looking at low-level misdemeanors. And in that case, I think that it would be a requirement of the court to advise the person before they testify that there's a possible privileged communication that's being gone into. I certainly have seen situations where courts have been have advised parties about possible privileges and suggested that they seek legal advice.
Thank you, Chair Prusansky and Vice Chair Boquist. Where this plays out frequently is when the police pull out a child in a school setting and they bring him. You're familiar with this.
And raise the question.
I would agree with you. The process unfolds frequently where the child says, "I want to talk to my parent." Sometimes you've got the school calling the parent. The parent's coming in, driving on a cell phone, saying, "I don't want any more questioning until I show up." But what happens is that the police or someone informed the child, you don't have the right to, you can't talk to your parent first because, A, your parent's not your attorney, and anything you say to your parent wouldn't be confidential anyway. It would be wonderful if there was some provision in the bill that would require some express informing of the child that, in fact, the privilege does exist. The problem is, of course, is that this would be new legislation and creating a privilege where one did not previously exist, and so it would be nice if there was some form of, not advertising, public notification that in fact a privilege had been created.
But let me broaden this a little bit more. There's a number of privileges on the books. Mm-hmm. None of them have, let's say, a requirement that they be informed or someone be informed of those privileges actually existing.
Right.
And so if we were going to do one with this particular legislation, then you'd be setting a new standard. And then the question is, how far are you going to extend that every time a police officer is going to conduct any type of investigation that could be in a family situation? You could see the officer reading out three or four different potential privileges before conducting the investigation.
If I may, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Boquist, this bill doesn't go to solve that problem. That problem exists because there is case law in Oregon that says that a parent can't assert for a child the right to remain silent. That there's a privileged communication between the parent and the child wouldn't change that situation at all. I think that that is another problem that we have in Oregon law regarding the when a child interacts with the legal system, especially a young child who doesn't necessarily understand what it means when a police officer tells them they have a right to remain silent. As an aside, I would say that 80% of the kids under 15 that I've represented, when I ask them what it means when a police officer tells them that you have a right to remain silent, will respond to me that that means they need to be quiet as long as the police officer's talking, and when the police officer stops talking, that's when they're supposed to start talking. So the reality is that this law would do nothing to change that that problem in Oregon law. What this would allow, however, is when you're notified that your child has been arrested or is being investigated and you sit down with your child and say, okay, you need to tell me what happened because I need to be able to, you know, decide what's going to happen, what decisions we should make, and the child says, you know, this is what happened, that parent who's trying to be a parent in that situation and help their child doesn't then be forced to testify against their child.
Counsel.
Ms. Bergman and Ms. Myers, I'm just trying to figure out under the circumstances. I mean, what we're talking about is a statement that the child or the parent made to each other, and I'm trying to think how this would play out in court. My assumption is, for example, if daddy told his son that he just robbed the convenience store, police officer asked the son what your dad said, and he tells him, okay, it now comes to court. How is that statement going to come in, particularly if there's a privilege? I mean, is it going to be to impeach daddy? I mean, I can't be offered for the truth or veracity of it because it's hearsay. So I'm just trying to figure out how this statement would play out in to be introduced into court as evidence.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee and counsel, as I read Section 2, it's only limited to communications made in confidence by the child to the child's parent.
Or vice versa.
Yes. No. I don't know that it is vice versa. The okay. Privilege exists at both ends of the communication, but it only protects the communication by the child to the parent.
Yep.
So if a parent makes an incriminating statement to a child and the parent is arrested and the parent is accused, I don't see that this bill would affect the right of that child.
Let's flip it. The son makes a comment to the parent, I robbed the convenience store. Mom tells the police officer. It goes to court. How would it come in? To impeach the son when he says, I didn't do it? I mean, how would a statement get in?
Chair Przanski, Counsel Taylor, it's not hearsay. It's a statement by a party. So it's just as if right now under current law, if a child tells a parent, I robbed a store and this is what I did, the parent could be called to testify to that because it's a statement of a party, which is not hearsay within the evidence rules. So,
could the parent assert the privilege at that time, or is this the trial waived it by its statement? Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
As I read this, the privilege could be claimed by both the child and the parent. So my understanding is that the child in that situation could say, I don't want my parent testifying to what I told them. It might be an interesting family dynamic if the parent says, I don't care, I want to testify and tell them what you told me. That would be setting up a new interesting family dynamic, but but the statement right now could come in because it's not hearsay.
Could the parent refuse to testify under this bill?
I believe the parent could refuse to testify under this bill and claim the privilege.
Okay.
So if it claims the privilege, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, then the statement could not come in, right?
That's correct. Just like I, as an attorney for my client, couldn't be called to testify what my client told me.
One further question, Mr. Chairman. Could the police officer testify as to what the parent told them?
Chair Przanski, Counsel Taylor, I don't believe so. I haven't done that research on hearsay, but I don't believe that they could, because it would go back to that still the privilege would exist.
It may come in as impeachment depending on
if the parent took the stand and depending on what the parent stated, but I agree that I don't think it would come in under the hearsay unless that person was actually on the stand and made some contradictory statement.
Chair Przanski, I agree. I think that if the parent were to get on the stand and say, my child didn't tell me anything, or my child told me he didn't do it, I think then the statement could come in.
Right. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Who is assigned the authority to either assert or waive the right of the minor child's confidentiality? I'm thinking of some child maybe 5 or 6 years old. Who decides that for the child?
Chair Przanski and Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, either the child could assert the privilege, the parent could assert the privilege, or the attorney for the child could assert the privilege, would be my sense.
I agree with that. I think the other thing is just under that scenario with the age, the child probably would not be within the juvenile system because of being under age 7, I think, or Kathy?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, in Oregon, there is no minimum age to be adjudicated of a delinquent act, so we actually have had children as young as 6 adjudicated as delinquents in Oregon. But, Senator Whitsitt, I think that the parent could assert it, the child could assert it, the attorney for the child, if there is one. The court could also name a guardian for the child as somebody who could assert the privilege. I have in the past been appointed as a guardian for a minor child to agree to a civil compromise because parents can't agree to a civil compromise on behalf of a minor child. So I've been appointed as the guardian to then agree or disagree for a civil compromise. So there is a system where the courts could then appoint a guardian. It could be a third person who has no dog in the fight. It could be another relative. It could be somebody else to assert the privilege on behalf of the child.
Then a parent could assert the privilege to prevent the child from testifying in order to protect the parent, then?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsitt, because the bill only protects confidential communication by the child to the parent, the child is facing a delinquent or criminal charge, the child could not be forced to testify if the child decided to testify on their own in their own defense. Then that's a different decision, but they couldn't be forced to testify if they're facing criminal or delinquent charges.
All right, there's no other questions. We have another panel. And so, ladies, thank you very much for testifying. Ms. Montgomery, thank you for coming forward. I've got, is it Mark McKechnie? And Diana Vettles, why don't you go ahead and come on up? I know that y'all are on the same side on this, but just set up the panel so we can do it. And Mark, you'll go first, please.
So not from the parent to the child, but from the child to the parent.
Good morning, Chair Blonsky, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the executive director of the Juvenile Rights Project in Multnomah County. Among our work that we do on behalf of children and youth in Oregon, we are a contracted public defense organization with the state of Oregon and represent children, youth, and parents who are involved in the juvenile court system, including youth charged with delinquent offenses. I'm not an attorney. I'm a social worker by experience and training, and Hopefully you've fully explored the legal issues with the last panel, and I can talk from a somewhat different perspective as a social worker, talking about the talking about child development and the importance of family in supporting positive youth development. I believe there's a compelling interest for the state to recognize in this way, in the way that Senate Bill 313 does, the vital importance of the parent-child relationship. Humans are somewhat unusual as a species in the length of our development. It takes roughly 2 decades for a human to mature physically, emotionally, and cognitively. So that's a very long time to be dependent upon others. And as we know, youth are known not for fully thinking through the consequences of their actions at times, for making rash decisions, and then suffering the consequences later. And it's important for children to be able to trust and rely upon adults and their parents in particular, sort of borrow their maturity, to borrow their judgment, to borrow their emotional stability, to borrow their foresight and their ability to weigh different consequences of different actions and to counsel the child on what the best decision is in some cases. And children, even though they don't display it, want to be able to trust their parents and want to be able to go to them, particularly when they've gotten themselves into a jam. And this bill helps encourage children to do that, to go to their parents and say, I don't know how this happened, but I'm in big trouble and I need some help. And we've talked about some of the barriers to that, but certainly I think in any way that the state can encourage that relationship, encourage honest and open communication between children and their parents, we should do so. When you look at the other types of privilege that exist in statute, the lack of a privilege between a child and their parents sticks out like a sore thumb. There's attorney-client privilege, privilege for physicians and psychologists, privilege for communications to a clergy member, various other types of privilege. These are people that we may go to for wise counsel to promote our own well-being, to protect our health, and protect our safety. And they can best do their jobs when we are candid with them, because we know that we enjoy a confidential and privileged relationship. When we communicate embarrassing or other types of information that we would normally be reluctant to convey to them, and that privilege helps encourage that candid and honest communication, and we should simply do that for children in communicating to their parents as well.
Mark, if I can get you to wrap up.
So, in sum, in case I haven't been clear yet, we support Senate Bill 313 and encourage you to pass it to the Senate floor.
Thank you, Diana.
Thank you. I'm Chair Prozesky, members of the committee. My name is Diana Vitolins, and I'm the Crook County District Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Generally, we believe it is a bad idea to create any new privileges. The district attorneys oppose any expansion of the privilege rules. These expansions typically restrict the ability of prosecutors to ascertain all information in a criminal proceeding and may hinder our ability to prosecute offenders. That being said, I think there may be some room for compromise in this bill. And the two examples that I'd like to give where I think as a real promise is first of all, the fact of the communication itself. It's not a confidential communication as written in the statute because other siblings and grandparents can be present. And so that necessarily, in my opinion, does not make a confidential communication. The second issue is there is no exception to prevent immediate harm to somebody else. And I'll give you this example. Son comes home and tells his mother that he's robbed an 80-year-old woman at the mall. And he left her behind the dumpster at the mall, and he doesn't know whether she's alive or not. He tells mother this, and mother does nothing. In this scenario, the privilege would be asserted, and there's no way that this parent would be required to give aid to the woman who is a victim in the case. And then the second example is you can have the child tell the mother that her boyfriend, mother's boyfriend, is sexually abusing her, and mother could assert the privilege and prevent the child's statement to the mother against the boyfriend from being used. And then finally, if you have a situation where a cousin of a family is coming over and the son in the home tells mother in front of the grandparent who lives in the home, I am sexually abusing the 8-year-old cousin who's coming over to the house. Both the grandmother can say nothing to prevent, and I might sexually abuse this cousin again. The grandmother can do nothing to talk to anybody about this because the privilege can be asserted by both the parent and the child. And so I guess talking with Mr. Neely, I think there's room to work on this, but those are the problems that I see with the bill.
Right. Senator Boquist.
I'm probably going to say the same thing you're going to say, Mr. Chair, because the second page of the bill exempts the child abuse issue. So the district attorneys didn't quite do a good review of it. I don't think that scenario would even be involved in the bill. And I would just make a comment, Mr. Chair. I think it's a great bill, but it doesn't go far enough.
All right. On page 2, lines 5, it looks like that one example of where the child is being abused would not be covered under the bill. But as I said at the beginning of this hearing, it's my intent to, let's say, just take public testimony today, and that we'll look at maybe some modifications. I do appreciate the point made as to maybe closing the communication down to just the parent and not having it expand when there's a whole room of people there that are family members. Other questions? All right. Thank you all very much.
I have a question for counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, is in this bill, in this section of the statute, is parent defined? And I'm wondering specifically if this covers step parents or, for example, domestic partners of the biological parent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Bonamici, I did not see a definition in there. That is a good question as to what is it to the scope. My assumption, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the parent would probably mean some kind of legal relationship, blood or adoption. At least in common law, I don't think you'd go beyond that.
Thank you.
So a boyfriend living in the house, I do not believe it would extend to that.
Right. I agree with that. But we all look at that to make sure that's tightened down. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 313? Not seeing him come forward. We'll close the public hearing on that one. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 314. Counsel, if you'll just give us the overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 314 comes to you from Senator Brzezinski, requests of Tom Sidwell, and requires a driver to report to law enforcement immediately an accident involving injury or death. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this statute is based on a similar statute that currently requires someone to report to the Department of Transportation, but to do so within 72 hours of an accident.
All right. Thank you. And colleagues, this is a bill that I've introduced on behalf of a police officer that's in Florence. The basis of this bill is basically there's no obligation currently for a person involved in an accident to report it to law enforcement. The concern, of course, is that if law enforcement isn't notified of these type of accidents, in many cases they're not able to be investigated and may go unaccounted for a number of hours or days, and that in itself causes the inability to move forward on the investigation and hold people accountable who have been involved in accidents. And as counsel says, that when you look at the statutes currently, there is an obligation to report to the Department of Motor Vehicles or ODOT regarding the accident, but that's a 72-hour window, and this is modeled after a law that's in Alaska. The one thing I will note at this point is that this would not be a crime. It would be only a violation, meaning only a fine could be imposed for a failure to do so. That's all I'm going to put on the record now. I didn't see anyone that had signed up for Senate Bill 314. Was there anyone that wanted to testify on 314? not seeing one Senator Boquist.
Just to make sure I know your intent, Mr. Chair, here, are we talking, which just sounds like it makes common sense, we're talking about ensuring that the driver calls 911 and makes a report that there has been someone injured so that we have a record? And I would be immediately more concerned that there's an injury and we make sure somebody gets treated medically and that gets taken care of.
But the bill as it's written
would be broader than just where there's an injury that occurs. And I think when you read the statute regarding where there is an injury, that's 811705, it does put a duty or a burden on the individual to make certain this person gets care. So you would assume that one of the things they would do if they had the access or ability to get word to medical personnel or to the authorities, they would do so. This would be broader in the sense that if you're involved in any accident that's required to be reported under the DMV, such as a property damage of $1,500 or more, that you'd also have a duty to contact local law enforcement by calling 911 or a local number to tell them that this accident has occurred. So it's just currently what happens if you are involved in an accident where it's only property and the owner of the property is not there, all you have to do is leave a note on the door or on the window someplace that's displayable to let them know that there's been this accident. And what we have found, at least in the jurisdictions I represent, that they believe it would be more punctual for the department to be notified relatively immediately or close there to the accident so they could take whatever steps they felt was necessary in the investigation.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, we're saying as long as the driver called 911, reported the accident, that would amount to reporting.
That would be it.
Okay. Sufficient reporting. Right?
Correct.
And then the police could follow up if it was so on and so forth.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wissett.
Just one quick question also. How would the drivers estimate the amount of damage? I mean, you said $1,500. I mean, if you hit a light pole, $1,500 damage on a Ford Taurus might not be anywhere, might be considerably more than on a Lexus or something. I mean, that bothers me. The $720 fine if you underestimate by a few bucks. You know?
Well, that's the requirement now for all of the reporting to DMV now is based on a monetary amount, and so individuals have to make that judgment call. Clearly, I think it would be a defense if someone in good faith thought that it was not a reportable offense of $1,500 or more in the damage arena. But that's current law for reports that are required when you have to fill out the accident reports and submit them to DMV.
What is the current violation and the fine for that?
That is a violation as well. I don't remember. I'll have to check that out. But there is a monetary, if you fail to report within, I think it's 72 hours to the Department of Motor Vehicles, that is an offense, which is, I believe, also a violation, not a crime.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 314. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 404.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 404 comes to us from the American Civil Liberties Union, repeals RRS 20.160 and 20.170. As chair, members of the committee, this is a statute that goes back to 1862, holds an attorney representing a non-resident plaintiff personally liable for any court costs that the plaintiff fails to pay.
All right, thank you. I have two people who want to testify. I'm going to ask both of them to come up. Andrea Meyer and Chris Schultz are the two I have.
Chairman of the committee, we just got the Dash 1 amendments, too.
Yeah. Dash 1 has just been handed out to committee members, and I assume, Andrea, you'll cover the Dash 1s as well.
I will. Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm speaking here today on behalf of our bill, Senate Bill 404. This does repeal, as Council Taylor said, an 1862 law. It repeals ORS 20.160 and 170. And for your aid, the statutes, because they are not printed on the bill, are on the back sheet of my testimony. But bottom line, what this law does is it holds attorneys who represent non-resident plaintiffs or foreign corporations, and in this case, foreign corporations or out-of-state corporations, businesses, It holds those attorneys personally liable for any costs awarded by the court if the non-resident or the out-of-state corporation fails to pay the cost. We're not talking about attorney's fees, just costs. In the alternative, attorneys who represent plaintiffs or defendants who are in-state residents are not personally liable for the costs that are incurred by their client. And the result is a disparate treatment of resident versus non-resident plaintiffs and corporations. ACLU believes it's unconstitutional, and we are currently challenging it before the courts. We are aware of no previous challenge to these statutes in the Oregon courts, and are not aware of any action currently other than this one where the costs have been charged against a plaintiff's attorney currently. But we are asking the legislature to repeal this law, and I think the policy reason is, as best we can tell, this law no longer has a reason for existing. While there is no legislative history back from the 1860s, I think it's fair to hypothesize that the reason was the ability to follow a out-of-state plaintiff or corporation to pursue against them a judgment of cost was a little bit more difficult than it is today. And today we have the physical and procedural process set up to allow it. Whether a service is provided by an attorney, a doctor, or a business owner, if the service is done professionally and in a proper manner, the provider, the attorney, the lawyer, the doctor or the business owner, shouldn't be held personally liable for the misdeeds of their client, patient, or customer who fails to meet their financial obligation. A person responsible for their debt should be held liable, and of course, costs are awarded to a defendant against a non-resident plaintiff or a corporation, the plaintiff should be pursued until the payment is received. I believe you have in your material today a letter from the Oregon State Bar Practices and Procedures Committee, which constitutes both civil plaintiff and defense attorneys. I believe it's under the letterhead Rose, Senders, and Bavarnik, my apologies, supporting the repeal of this law. So, I don't want to say it's rare, but you do both have the plaintiff's civil bar and the defense civil bar in agreement, and I know the bar did circulate this to folks. You have the dash one amendments before you, so that section two can clearly apply to the current action. As I mentioned, we are challenging it, and the only issue in that case, the only issue is the constitutionality of that provision. And we believe that if this law is repealed, no further resources by anyone, including the court, should go on to determine the constitutionality of a law that we hope will have been repealed. So the only problem is, because this is an 1860 law, the language in it is a little odd, and it talks about holding the attorney in contempt. So the dash one amendments, as you'll see from the bill, Section 2 already appears to apply to current actions, and what the dash 1 does is try to capture the 1860 language just to make sure that if that is your decision, it actually is effective when we are all said and done. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions and urge this committee to move forward by adopting the dash 1s, and when you have the fiscal, which I can only anticipate should be zero, that you will move this bill out. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris?
Senator Prasansky and members of the committee, I'm Chris Schultz with the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. We're a coalition of trade associations and businesses working on tort and lawsuit issues. We'll have bigger issues to talk to you about in 2009, but we're also watching in this legislative session small things that could have unintended consequences. I'm here today to testify as neutral on this bill, but just wanted to raise one concern. This committee introduced two bills, Senate Bill 308, which is prospective, and Senate Bill 404, which is identical, except it's retroactive to cases that could still be subject to appeal. And I've had a good talk with Ms. Meyer from the ACLU. My understanding is a case that is at issue, it's a public agency that's going after a plaintiff's attorney for $800 in costs because the plaintiff is out of state and can't be found. I guess the concern about unintended consequences is we really have no idea how many cases where costs have been awarded against the plaintiff, and that's a foreign plaintiff, and we have no idea how many cases are still subject to appeal where this could be reopened. So if the only issue is cleaning up an 1862 law, the prospective bill seems more likely to not have any unintended consequences. If the committee is comfortable that there's only this one case that will be affected by the retroactive provision, then I'm happy to be told that our concern about unintended consequences is misplaced. And that's all. Thank you.
Chris, thank you for bringing that point to us. This will, we'll have that in our working knowledge. Any questions for Senator Dingfelder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Andrea. Are there other states that still hold lawyers liable for out-of-state clients?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dingfelder, I did my best to sort of survey, and I asked, and I can... The answer is apparently not, except maybe in Florida on a bond issue that is archaic as ours is. But it's my understanding when I asked, and I asked my legal intern whom I have to survey, I could not find this as a general practice. In fact, most attorneys that we talked to when this issue came forward to us never even knew this law existed. And I would just briefly respond to Mr. Schultz. Well, you know, one can always talk about unintended consequences, and we want to be sensitive to that. I think it's safe to say that having had this circulated before the Oregon State Bar and all its members, having had the civil practitioners on both sides weigh in, if there was anything outstanding that was serious, I would have hoped it would have been brought forward in that. But for our case in challenging the constitutionality, and the reason the original bill, it was always intended, we intended at least to offer this as to cover the current case because of... simply the resources being expended, it would be, we thought, not the best policy to repeal the statute and then have the court still handling this matter.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 404? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing. We're going to go into work session with colleagues, and I'm going to start with the first bill, which is Senate Bill 233, open up a work session. And Council, remind us where we're at and
Mr.
what we...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that's referred to as the Victims' Rights Bill. It implements HJR 49 and 50 from last session. That was from the February session that was passed. That was enacted in May. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the dash two amendments in front of you, and what they basically do, going over to page 20 of the bill, it clarifies who's going to notify the victim. What I can do on page 20, line 4, it currently reads upon, let me read the language still there and make the sentence complete. The victim has the right, A, upon request made within the time period prescribed in the notice required by ORS 147.417 to be notified, and then you go to the amendment and state of any hearing before the court that may result in revocation of the defendant's probation for a felony or Class A misdemeanor. The notification shall be provided by, it. This is where the parties sat down and worked this issue out. The district attorney, if the defendant is not supervised by the supervisory authority, or if the defendant is supervised by the supervisory authority and the district attorney initiates a request with the court for a probation violation or revocation hearing, and then B, the supervisory authority, if the defendant is supervised by the supervisory authority and the supervisory authority initiates a request for the court for a probation violation or revocation hearing. And then going down to line 11, it will insert a person, Class A misdemeanor has the meaning given that term in the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. Chair, members of the committee, that's the amendment to the bill. You have a fiscal impact statement in front of you. Basically, it's in many regards indeterminate because it's difficult to tell the cost given the fact that most of the cost is probably generated by the initiative amendments to the Constitution that the voters approved.
All right. Thank you. So it looks like we need to have a motion on the dash two amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into the main bill.
Senator Roquist moves the dash twos into Senate Bill 233. Is any discussion? Any objection? No objection, so ordered. And now a move on the full bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 233 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Volquist moves Senate Bill 233 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just wanted to discuss the, this has a subsequent referral, is that correct?
It does.
Talk about that.
Oh, it wouldn't be, no, this one does not.
74 does.
Indeterminate.
Yeah. Okay.
didn't cross the threshold.
Any other thoughts?
No.
Okay. So the only thing I'm going to put on the record, it does show in the dash twos that these obligations are where the initiative is done by either the district attorney or the supervising authority. So that would be the limitation that's on this, and it seems appropriate to the chair for those type of situations, because those entities would actually have knowledge as compared to if it was starting up through the court, through some type of court process. So with that, I am supportive of the bill. And was there any other discussion?
I did want to discuss just to make sure that we have this on the record and are clear that in the fiscal analysis, it does talk about additional activities by the court and the Justice Department and the Public Defense Services and the Justice Department and the Judicial Department. So is there a new fiscal that doesn't have that in there? Because I'm trying to understand why we aren't having the discussion about the fiscal that's involved with this.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, one of the difficult things in this bill, and I've discussed this with LFO to a certain extent, and I also remember a memo when the Senator and I were participating in a work group from Pete Shepard, and that is that the difficulty in determining, and I've had the same discussion with the courts, in determining what is driven by the constitutional provision and what is extra, if anything, by the statute. This statute is basically, proposed statute is a roadmap on how to carry out the provisions in the Oregon Constitution.
So, in essence, the fiscal impact is created by amending the Constitution, not by the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Bonamici, I think so.
No, that's the understanding. I think what we're going to do is go ahead and move this forward. I think we've set a record. It's got to go over to the House side, and if they feel that it needs to be referred somewhere on the line to Ways and Means, it should be. But I've always taken the position on these type of bills. These are basically implementation statutes for what has been approved, in this case, by the voters through their vote.
And if, Mr. Chair, if I may, it's my understanding that many of these actions are already undertaken by the
That's
courts,
correct.
And so it's not an additional burden. It's codifying what they're doing in many instances already.
Yeah, I'd say what not only what the courts are doing, but what the district attorneys or their supervising authorities are doing, since they're not part of the court. Any other?
Just for the record, I concur with both you, Mr. Chair, and with Senator Bonamici.
All right, thank you. So is there any objection? Not hearing any. We'll go to the floor, and the chair will carry this one. And the last one, we'll close that work session on Senate Bill 233 and open a work session on Senate Bill 74.
Mr. Chair, the committee Senate Bill 74 has a referral to Ways and Means Committee. It requires a person on probation of parole applying to have his or her supervision transferred to another state so the person can move to have the state pay an application fee.
And this one does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
And was there anything else that we needed to do besides take action on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, no.
All right, Chair would take a motion on Senate Bill 74. That would be a motion to approve or whatever the position is going to be and a referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote no, but can I make the motion?
If you'd like, sure.
I don't have a problem with that. Mr. Chair, I move SB 74 to Ways and Means.
With a DPAS or with a...
I don't know.
With no recommendation or...
With the recommendation is fine.
Okay. So if I got this right, Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 74 with a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means.
I'm going to speak to him.
And that's the correct motion. Then we'll go into discussion. Senator Boquist first, and then Senator Wessett, and we'll let you. Oh, you want to?
I'll let.
Senator Wessett?
Just a clarification, is this a recommendation that Ways and Means do pass it, or that it's a do pass if it gets through Ways and Means to the floor?
I'm in the latter camp.
Normally, it's a recommendation to Ways and Means as to what we as the Substantive Committee believe should happen with the bill. I've seen them sent down either with a due pass recommendation or taking no position. And the chair is fine with either of those, knowing that this is going to go to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to amend my motion.
All right, Senator Boqvist has amended his motion. The motion now that's before us is to send Senate Bill 74 to the Ways and Means Committee for further action.
Yeah, my motion, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't have a problem with the bill itself. The concern is in looking at the fiscal that it's written in a manner that it doesn't look like it pays for itself, and if this program doesn't pay for itself internally, then I wouldn't want to be recommending it, which is my concern with the bill.
All right, I understand that, and I think that was pretty well put on the record, and hopefully they'll have the bean counters being able to figure that out in Ways and Means. Any other discussions? Any objections?
I'm a no vote to make sure they do that, Mr. Chair.
All right, and so Senator Boqvist will be noted as a no vote. Any other no votes at this time? No one else, and so the motion passes. The bill will be referred to Ways and Means with no recommendation for further consideration. And Council, anything else we need to do in our closing minutes?
Chair, members of the committee, not that I know.
All right, thank you very much. I expect that we will be back here tomorrow at 8:30, our regular meeting time. I thank the committee for indulging me with my constituent work that I have to do on Mondays.